You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Tuesday, May 26, 2015. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Masha Gessen, on her book, The Brothers, The Road to American to an American Tragedy, about the Tsarnaev brothers, Johar and Tamerlan. Johar, just a week or two ago, was sentenced to the death penalty for his role in the Boston Marathon bombing. Also on the program today, that fast-track authority that finally made it through the Senate on Friday has a poison pill in it. One that really makes you shake your head when you hear the president say this is one of the most progressive trade deals we've ever signed. Also on the program, the Koch brothers announced this weekend their strategy to win in the Republican presidential sweepstakes. They're going to buy them all. They're literally going up to the roulette table and saying, how many slots can we vote? We bet on? 32? Okay. Yeah, we'll do all 32. And NSA reform, or I guess de facto NSA reform, seems to be here. The Senate will not be able to, or it appears they're scrambling to pass something to maintain the Patriot Act reauthorization that needs to happen within the next 5 days. Also, a new report on King v. Burwell. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, the Supreme Court case that could very well make it impossible for millions of Americans to get health insurance. The Times does a deep dive and looks for anybody who's involved in the drafting of the Affordable Care Act, Republican or Democrat alike, who will say, yeah, no, it was we never contemplated the idea of giving subsidies to exchanges set up by the state. All that and more on today's program, folks. The story of the poison pill and the TPP is fascinating. It really is disturbing. I'm just going to tease it for you because we got to take a quick break. And you non-members will hear our pitch about Credo Mobile, and we will get to Masha Gessen. But let me just set this TPP thing up for you. We'll talk more about it in the better half of the program after we interview Masha. It has to do with the fact that apparently Malaysia is so wed to the use of slave labor that any anti-human trafficking provision that was embedded into this fast-track authority could scuttle the deal for Malaysia. So just keep that in mind when you hear about the most progressive trade deal. Apparently, our past trade deals not only had no problem with human slavery or with slavery, but some of them may have promoted it. Well, that's an exaggeration. But all right, we're going to take a quick break. We're going to be talking to Masha Gessen right after this. Hey, Majority Report listener, this episode of the Majority Report, in fact, this month's episodes of the Majority Report is sponsored by Credo Mobile. Join America's only progressive phone company. Credo Mobile funds Credo Action, which lobbies on all the issues that you care about. TPP, NSA reform. They fight the Koch brothers. They fight things like ALEC. They've raised $78 million since 1985 for progressive nonprofit groups like the ACLU, the Sierra Club, and the Union of Concerned Science. Credo has also been the largest corporate donor to Planned Parenthood with more than $2 million in donations over the years. Here's the simple math. The more progressives who join Credo Mobile, the harder it can fight and the more it can contribute to progressive nonprofits. They are making an incredible deal for Majority Report listeners this month. $100 off of any phone, plus 25% off your data plan fees for 1 year. Also, if you're stuck in somebody else's contract, or I guess your own contract, but with some other carrier, they will give you up to $350 per line credit on your Credo bill towards an early termination fee. They will also give you up to $300 in trading credit for your current phone. You can check out an estimate of your phone's value at credomobile.com/trade-in. But the bottom line, all of this is available if you go to credomobile.com/majority report. Check out the special deal for Majority Report listeners. You can also call 800-966-1665. Use the offer code 501-882. Check it out. We also have a link at majority.fm, of course. But Credo Mobile, they're a great phone company that works and shares the same values as you do. Check it out again, credomobile.com/majority report. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program Masha Gessen. She is the author of several books in addition to being a widely published reporter. Her latest, The Brothers, The Road to an American Tragedy, about the Tsarnaev brothers. Masha, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So let's for people who are not aware of the sort of the general outline of the Tsarnaevs and the Tsarnaev families, I guess, road to the United States as immigrants. Can you just give us the sort of the broad outlines?
Well, their road was more of a zigzag. The parents, Zubeda and Anzor Tsarnaev, met in Western Siberia. Then they went to Kyrgyzstan, where Anzor, the father, had grown up. Then they moved to Kalmykia on the Caspian Sea, about 1,500 miles away. Then they moved, they had their oldest son, Tamerlan, there. They moved back to Kyrgyzstan. They lived there for a few years, and then they moved to Chechnya. Anzor, the father, was Chechen, but he'd never actually lived in Chechnya because Chechens had been deported to Central Asia in 1944 by Stalin. So they moved to Chechnya, and their timing was terrible because the war in Chechnya began almost as soon as they got there. And by that, they had Jahar, the youngest brother, in Chechnya, and they also, by that time, had two daughters in between. So with four small children, they went back to Kyrgyzstan. That's, again, that's about 1,500 miles. They stayed in Kyrgyzstan for a few years. They tried going back to the North Caucasus, to Dagestan, which is next door to Chechnya. And again, their timing couldn't have been worse. The war in Chechnya spread to Dagestan right around the time they got there. And then finally, a couple of years later, they moved to the United States. So oddly, the U.S., Cambridge, Massachusetts, in fact, is the single place where the family lived the longest.
And the fascinating thing, I mean, about knowing that history, I mean, there's two things that strike me. Obviously, I mean, it's important for us to know that story because the point of your book, I think, and is to get a greater understanding of these two in the hopes of understanding, you know, why they did it. And it's obviously that part is important too. What also strikes me is that the family seems to do much better, and maybe it's just because time catches up with them, but they seem to do much better in terms of a cohesion through that first part of the story, and things begin to fall apart when they come to the United States.
I'd put it a little bit differently. I think that they life made sense to them while they were striving for something. They kept looking for a place where they would bring up their kids and give them an education. And I really do think that's what they wanted to do, and they were totally sincere in this quest. And when they got to the U.S., at first things looked pretty good. It looked like they were sort of on the right track. And then nothing quite worked out. Tamerlan's boxing career didn't work out, not because he lacked talent. Zubeidat, the mother's career as a beautician, didn't work out, not because she didn't work hard enough, but because the financial crisis hit, that sort of thing. And so when all of that crumbled, they had no further place to go. I mean, where do you go after the United States? They've already landed in paradise, as far as they knew. This was the place where they were going to accomplish their dreams. I think that's why the collapse of the dreams, which was sort of slow and tragic, was so painful and was such a dead end.
So tell us about Tamerlan. Tamerlan, of course, is the older brother, and I don't know if we still really even have a sense of what the true dynamic was between Johar and Tamerlan. But tell us about Tamerlan, and then we'll talk about their dynamic and Johar.
So Tamerlan, who was killed in a shootout with the police, although ultimately it seems that his final injury was inflicted by Jahar when he ran over him in the car. So at the age of 27, 4 days after the bombing, he had been an extremely intelligent, hardworking, beautiful young man. And he was the star of the family, not just because he was the oldest son, although that's extremely important in the Chechen culture, but really because he was such such an extraordinary boy, sort of the golden boy of the family. He was a very good student, again, very hardworking. But when they got to the U.S., when he finally got here, he was about 16 years old. It was clear that his dreams probably weren't going to be fulfilled through his academic accomplishments. And they decided he would be a competitive boxer, and he would get on the U.S. Olympic team. And it wasn't a crazy dream. He was an extremely talented boxer, and he started winning amateur competitions as soon as he started entering them. But then the Golden Gloves Association changed its rules and stopped letting non-citizens compete. And that killed that dream. And his collapse was sort of slow and horrifying. He dropped out of a community college. He became increasingly religious and then sort of nut-a-leaf and fanatical, both as in terms of becoming an adherent of more and more radical Islam, but also more and more radical sort of American-grown political theories, reading all sorts of right-wing conspiracy theory broadsheets. He was unemployed. He was delivering pizzas. He was also running drugs. He went to Dagestan, where his mother was from, so in the North Caucasus, for about 6 months in 2012. And that seemed to be an extraordinary experience for him. He was taken seriously. He didn't feel like a failure there. He found some of his relatives and made some new friends with whom he sat around and talked about the need to establish Sharia law around the world and overturn these anti-Muslim governments. And as far as he was concerned, the U.S. and Russia were pretty much the equivalent in that sense.
So, okay, so I want to just back up. When you talk about the right-wing broadsides, the conspiracies, I'm curious as to, and this is my own, but what were those, like of what ilk?
Oh, there was sort of radical libertarian, radical right-wing anti-Semitic, but, you know, American-grown, not...
Right. InfoWars. InfoWars, is that a big one? The
that sort of thing, yes. Yeah.
And so my understanding, so when he went to Dagestan, it seems to be that it was less about him becoming radicalized, and I'm not even sure in this context that word necessarily works, but that it wasn't so much... He was acting upon his a fervent religious belief as much as it impacted him as he had a taste of what it was like, sort of the alternate version of what his life could have been, maybe.
That's what I think. And I think to some extent or another, it always happens to people who go back to places from which they were removed as children. I've experienced that as an immigrant. I've interviewed a lot of immigrants who've gone through that. It is a radical experience. It's just a completely different kind of radical experience than we usually mean by radicalization. But the thing is, the whole radicalization narrative doesn't apply just in this case. It doesn't really apply in any case. It's not like people are generally drafted by some large international terrorist organization and slowly taken through the paces. People are generally freelancers, and the initiative is usually their own. And in this particular case, they were pretty self-contained. And it doesn't seem that he was necessarily exposed to any new radical beliefs in Dagestan. He went through a personal transformation in Dagestan.
Well, I mean, what do we mean when we say radicalized? I mean, what is that when, you know, what does that mean for you in the context of this story?
Well, to me, it doesn't mean much of anything, because I think it's an odd theory that doesn't have much of a basis in reality. If you listen to the FBI, then what you learn is that an international organization recruits young men, usually it's young men, and takes them through a process called radicalization, where they start out as pre-radicalized, and then they're radicalized, and then they become terrorists. What terrorism scholars will tell us is that it actually doesn't look like that, that radical beliefs are not a particularly good predictor of terrorist behavior. Most people, and you know, when I say it, it seems intuitive, most people who hold radical beliefs, including radical beliefs that support violence, don't actually engage in terrorist behavior.
Right.
But what's even stranger is that some terrorists don't hold particularly radical beliefs, or don't hold them deeply, or haven't held them for long. And I think that's much more important. There's something about the lure of terrorism that doesn't have anything to do, or doesn't have much to do with radical beliefs. It has to do with the sense of belonging to something greater, the sense of becoming somebody, and being able to, you know, stand up for what you perceive as justice.
That's interesting. I mean, and just to be clear, when we talk about radical beliefs, we're talking about any belief system that wants to fundamentally change the way a particular society or all societies are organized.
Yes, and I would add to that, it's implied that through violent means, the system wants to fundamentally change the system of society.
I mean, that's sort of the problem, right? Is that it's implied by violent means, but that's actually not necessarily the case, A, and B, one doesn't follow, right? I mean, what you're saying is that attraction to terrorism is a function of a psychological need that has that the rest of the stuff is window dressing.
I wouldn't go quite so far as to say it's window dressing, but it doesn't seem to be essential. What seems to be essential is that terrorism really offers the opportunity to belong to something great, something glorious. And that that desire is, it is particularly evocative for people who feel like nobodies. So it's no surprise that, again, terrorism scholars will tell us this, that terrorists are often most often found among immigrants. I mean, nobody feels disenfranchised and nobody feels like a nobody more than an immigrant does. So in that sense, no surprises there. But also, you don't just get to belong to something greater. You also get to declare war on a great power. So that's the very opposite of being a nobody. And the incredible thing is the great power takes your declaration of war seriously. I mean, right. We do treat terrorists as enemy combatants instead of treating them as common criminals.
Right. So all of a sudden, Tamerlan, who is one day a pizza delivery guy and had his dreams as a boxer dashed, he can then actually engage the world's greatest power in a war by himself.
Exactly. And the United States government doesn't say to him, you have committed a heinous crime, and we will treat you like a common criminal, like we treat any other murderer, or even a school shooter. We will treat you with the sort of grand fear and respect that we actually accord those that who we're at war with.
Right. It's perverse, but there is a certain bestowing of glory, right, on them, as opposed to a criminal who's responsible for this stuff.
I think that's where the war on terror really, really takes a wrong turn. And I think that we've become very used to that. You know, the spectacle, for example, of the leaders of the free world marching in formation through the streets of Paris in response to the Charlie Hebdo massacre in January was, to me, really jarring, because I think that's sort of exactly what those criminals wanted. They wanted their murder to frighten and mobilize the people that they hate most and the people that the cartoonists were sort of used as stand-ins for. And I think it might be a lot more effective, or certainly it would be more right to treat them the way we treat other murderers.
Right. I mean, in some respects, that response is sort of the ransom, I guess. Let's talk about Zohar. So Tamerlan comes back to the United States after 6 months in Dagestan, and at the very least, it is he has to readjust to not being someone who is, I guess, feels part of something larger than him. And in some respects, probably, you know, there's probably a quality when he goes to Dagestan of, like, he's the guy who's been in America and he's been traveling, and he's not the sort of the same, I guess. I don't know. Would it be fair to say in Dagestan he's a mini celebrity within, like, very sort of narrow confines?
Yes, I think that's absolutely fair to say, and that's quite insightful, in fact. And, yeah, his relatives introduce him as their relative from America. People are interested in hearing him talk about America. And he's a good talker. Again, he's a smart guy. He has some good analysis of what's good and bad about America. He talks about how good it is that it's a truly pluralistic society and there's free speech, and how horrible it is that it's a racist society and that there's a lot of anti-Muslim sentiment. He talked about police corruption. He talked about sort of all the normal stuff, and he got a lot of attention. And he has to come back to the U.S., where he's a stay-at-home husband. He wears sweats all day long, and he stays with his three-year-old daughter while his wife goes out to work as a home health aide. By all accounts, he's a good, attentive father, but that's certainly not the life that he was just having, being a mini celebrity in Dagestan.
At one point, he's and correct me if I'm wrong, he's dealing marijuana and he's doing it with some other people, and there's some question as to whether or not he murdered those other people. Is that right?
In September 2011, there was a horrifying triple murder in Waltham, Massachusetts. One of the men killed was Tamerlan's best friend, Brendan Ness, who was a major pot dealer, and two others were also acquaintances of his who were also involved in drug dealing. And at the time, the murder wasn't investigated in any significant way. It was sort of written off as a drug-related crime, even though it was a really bizarre crime. I mean, they were their throats were slashed so that they were nearly beheaded. It was clearly not a robbery because there was cash and drugs strewn all over them when the bodies were found. But it sort of goes silent for a while, and then after the Marathon bombing and after Tamerlan was killed, the Massachusetts State Police, or the Massachusetts District Attorney, said that that Tamerlan was now the prime suspect in that murder. But the case still hasn't been closed, and even more bizarrely, when the Massachusetts State Police started investigating the murder again after Tamerlan's death, and the Massachusetts FBI, the Boston FBI, went out to Florida to interview a friend of Tamerlan's, another Chechen man, whom they suspected of having been his accomplice, and the FBI agent shot him during the interview when he supposedly became violent, and he was killed. And
this is Ibrahim Todoshev, right?
This is Ibrahim Todoshev, yes.
Okay, and actually, I want to circle back to this this stuff, okay, because this stuff is fascinating to me, and also, you know, I mean, it's just the having come from Massachusetts myself, I know that you spent some time there too. You know, the story of Whitey Bulger and the relationship with the FBI and the sort of the criminal activity Bulger was involved in. I'm not making any illusions. I'm just saying there's a story that, you know, that there's a paradigm out there that has existed in Massachusetts. I don't know if it's specific to Massachusetts or what, but that was just weird. But I want to circle back there, because I do want to talk a little bit about Johar, and then we'll come back to that if we could.
Absolutely.
So Tamerlan comes back and we're, like I say, we'll circle back also to that killing, because it's a very strange killing, right? To kill for drugs and money and not take any drugs or money. But Tamerlan comes back, and Johar at this point had gone through high school and was considered sort of a, I don't know if golden boy is accurate, but pretty close, it sounds like. Go ahead.
He was a popular guy. He wasn't, unlike Tamerlan, he was never a superstar, but he was universally liked. Everybody thought he was charming. He was captain of the wrestling team. He worked with disabled kids. He was sort of everybody's and nobody's friend. He was also smoking a lot of pot, which nobody seemed to notice. And he seemed to be going down a spiral of his own, which also no one seemed to notice. When he was applying to colleges, even though he was a very good student, he applied to fairly non-competitive schools, and then he went to the least competitive of the ones that he got into. He went to University of Massachusetts Dartmouth and proceeded basically to nearly flunk out. It's actually weird that that they kept him there until the middle of his second semester of his sophomore year, because he was failing out of everything. He kept changing his major. Mostly he was dealing drugs on campus. He became the campus drug dealer and playing video games. His social circle shrank. He was hanging out with kids who were sort of marginalized, and two of his best friends were students from Kazakhstan who'd just come over to study, so they didn't speak much English. He spoke Russian to them. And oddly, for an immigrant kid who came over at the age of 8, he was sort of reinventing a Russian-speaking Chechen identity for himself. He created Russian online accounts. He was posting in Russian painstakingly. It's very difficult if your schooling stopped in first grade to write in a language. So he was making a huge effort in that department. And by all accounts, he was depressed and having a really hard time.
I mean, so do you have a sense? I mean, there's a couple of things that are telling. One, the fact that nobody was really aware of this sort of downward spiral that he was going through indicates that this is a kid who is, even though it appears that people really liked him, certainly felt alienated and was in many respects alienated Is there any sense that you have of what happened?
Well, it seems that what kept him sort of his depression and his difficulties invisible was exactly what usually charmed people. He was a sort of perfect mirror of a kid. He just always said to people exactly what they wanted to hear from them, from him. He was the kind of kid who charmed the world out of his wrestling coach, because after he wrestled for the first time, he asked what he could have done better. And so soon enough, he was captain of the wrestling team. But everyone I talked to, no one had ever had an in-depth conversation with the guy. Everyone had heard from him exactly what they wanted to hear. I think we've all known people like that. I think those are the people who are least capable of asking for help when they need it. They just sort of keep mirroring. So I think
do you think that has something to do with his, being an immigrant, coming at that age, or traveling around in the way that they did before they landed in the United States? Like, this is the way, they're finding this sort of like very effective way of protecting your family. I mean, it sounds like this is a family under threat for the years before they came to the United States.
Yeah, this is armchair psychology on my part, so I try to be a little careful. But yeah, it seems like it's a great way to assimilate, is to just mirror back. And I think that all immigrants do that to some extent. And I certainly saw my own kids when they were younger doing exactly that. It's a good way to learn a language. It's a good way to learn local customs. If it becomes exactly who you are, you're in big trouble.
And so let's, we don't have too much more time, and I want to get your take on the sentencing and the trial, largely speaking. Johar's defense basically made no defense of him in terms of actually committing the crime. And it ultimately shifted to basically what the punishment was going to be. Give me your sense of that defense strategy and of the sentencing of death.
Well, in retrospect, it was a big gamble what they did. They the defense was very careful to not cross-examine any of the victims or even eyewitnesses of the bombing. They did not try to poke any holes in the prosecution's case, although holes could certainly be poked. It was an incredibly well-tried case, but there are a lot of gaps in the story that the prosecution told. But the defense was very careful not to do that in order not to alienate the jury. So the message they were putting across was that they were talking about a terrible tragedy, and Johar was one of the victims of that tragedy. He was brainwashed by his brother. He was forced to participate in the bombing. He experienced remorse, and he certainly should. And he wasn't contesting the fact that he was part of the horrible events, and he shouldn't be put to death. It looked brilliant at the time. It may well have been the best chance that the defense had, but they failed. The jury didn't even really spend any time deliberating. And, the jury was deliberating for 14 and a half hours, but they had a 24-page questionnaire, very dense, 38 different questions that they had to vote on. So basically all they had time to do was
read
their instructions and the questions, count the hands, and go on to the next question. They never got into an in-depth discussion of whether this person should actually be put to death.
What were the gaps in the story?
Well, there are two major problems with the story, and these are not the prosecution's problems. These are the FBI's problem. The one major question is, where were the bombs made? The FBI testified that they still don't know. They weren't made in Tamerlan's apartment, and they weren't made in Johar's dorm room. So there's a third place. That suggests that at least one other person was involved. This person may have been unwittingly involved. This person may not have known what their space was.
Why does that necessarily, why couldn't they have done it, let's say, they couldn't have done it at a facility that they would have rented, right? So they couldn't have done it at a storage unit because there would have been some trace, I guess, theoretically, unless maybe they went and rented it in cash. right?
That's
possible.
But again, the FBI would track down that place to find out whether it was some sort of thing where whoever rented them the space didn't know what was going on, or whether there was actually a full-fledged accomplice. So we don't know the answer to that question. And the other question we don't know an answer to is, what was the relationship between Tamerlan and the FBI? What we do know is that in 2011, the FBI interviewed Tamerlan 3 times because he had been flagged as a terrorism risk by the Russians. And we know that at least during the second interview, the FBI tried to recruit him as an informant, which is sound and normal practice for the FBI to take someone like that and try to recruit him as an informant.
How do we know that?
We know that from people who heard it, and we also know that from a defense filing.
Okay.
In the case, so what we don't know is what happened after. Did Tamerlan think he was leading the FBI on? Was the FBI led on? On the face of it, we have a situation where someone who was fingered as a terrorism risk, who was interviewed, who was known by face to the FBI, built bombs and set them off at the largest public gathering in Boston, creating the largest terrorist attack since 9/11 in the United States, without the FBI knowing this was happening. So that's an obvious question that the FBI needs to answer. It's not the court's job to make the FBI answer it. It's the Congress's job.
Right, or theoretically, the defense to raise that and build some theory around it, right? I mean, in the case. So give us, what's the timeline in 2011 of the murders that the FBI now says that they believe Tamerlan committed, and the times when the FBI met with him in 2011?
Right. So the FBI met with him in spring-summer 2011, and the murders were committed on September 11th, 2011.
Wow.
So this does raise the question again of, if this was someone who was watched by the FBI, is it possible that he would have committed a horrifying triple murder?
I mean, when people talk about Tamerlan now, there's nothing that you've described about him that would suggest that type of violence. I mean, is that, or is there? I mean, to me, that those seem like stories of two different people.
Well, I think we always say that about people
who
commit violent acts, and there's a reason for that. You know, most people don't commit violent acts until they do. He certainly was not a sweet-tempered guy. He was once arrested for domestic violence. He could certainly get into a fight. He was once slugged a kid in high school for having gone out with his sister, who wasn't allowed to go out with boys. So he was not averse to violence.
And what's the theory of why this guy would have killed these three men but not taken the drugs and the money?
No theory. The crime is still open. The investigation is still open. After identifying him as a suspect, Massachusetts authorities have said nothing more about why they think he was a suspect or why they think he committed the murder.
There was a review of your book by Janet Napolitano, where she says at one point that you seem to become a conspiracy theorist. She postulates the FBI recruited Tamerlan as an informant during their visits to the Tsarnaev home in 2011. That's not you postulating that as much as that's the defense, right?
That's correct. In fact, you know, there's nothing in the book that doesn't come from a document or an interview. And I'm extremely skeptical of most conspiracy theories. In fact, I think conspiracy theories flower where there's a conspicuous lack of information. That's what I'm trying to point to in the book, is this is how we get conspiracy theories. And some of the conspiracy theories sound a little bit more plausible than others, but ultimately we just need to get the answers.
Let me ask you about what I want to continue to read from her thing, because she writes, she then, speaking of guessing you, surmises that Tamerlan went rogue and participated in the killing of three friends with whom he dealt marijuana. Well, that's not your surmise. right? That's correct. That's the FBI.
The DA, yes.
Okay.
The district attorney, yeah.
It's just a weird way of Napolitano trying to sort of lay certain things on your doorstep that aren't really your, you know, aren't really yours, with all due respect. She goes further, speaking of you, and suggests that after the bombings, the FBI delayed telling Boston law enforcement about Tamerlan's identity because they wanted to reach him first, kill him, and hide his presence as an informant. Talk about that, because that is, I mean, is that a, do you suggest that? Do you think that's possible? What would support that claim?
Well, it was actually first suggested not by me, but by Senator Chuck Grassley, who wrote a letter to the FBI asking for information on that because information had come to his office indicating that Boston police and Cambridge police had encountered FBI agents in Cambridge on the night that finally ended in the manhunt. So that particular allegation that the FBI delayed identifying him and that the FBI was not sharing information with other law enforcement agencies that are part of the Joint Terrorist Task Force and that were involved in the manhunt comes from Senator Chuck Grassley.
That's interesting. Now, has anything in your reporting borne that out?
Let's look at the situation sort of on the face of it. On the face of it, we have someone who was interviewed by the FBI, who was known by face to the FBI. The bombings occurred on Monday afternoon. By Tuesday morning, FBI technical experts had identified the faces of the men from surveillance tapes that they believed were the suspects, and they were indeed the Tsarnaev brothers. And then for 3 days, the FBI could not identify Tamerlan Tsarnaev, and in fact, the FBI tells us that they didn't positively ID him until they took his fingerprints when he was dead early on Friday morning. So how is it possible that the field agent or agents who had gone out to interview Tamerlan Tsarnaev just 2 years earlier were not shown the pictures or couldn't recognize him in the pictures? It's possible, I guess. It
right.
speaks to incredible incompetence.
Do you know if these field agents, I mean, presumably these are field agents from the Boston area. Are they still stationed in Boston? Are they still with the FBI 2 or 3 years later? I mean, I guess if, you know, these guys were, 2 years away from retirement and they went to retirement and they just, you know, looked up this as they're living in the beach in Hawaii and they said, oh, you know, I used to work that beat. I mean, what...
conceivable. Although, you know, if I were running the investigation, I would.
I would try to find those guys on the beach in Hawaii.
Yeah.
I'm just trying to say, like, you know, there's incompetence, and then there's something that's not incompetence. Do you know if these same field agents were still in Boston? Let's say on that day. I mean, were they still working out of the Boston office, or?
I don't know, and this is not the kind of information that the FBI would normally release.
Right.
We would need an oversight agency to force the FBI to release it. And, you know, after 9/11, there was the Senate report on 9/11 that exposed intelligence agencies' failure to prevent and to act on information that it had that failed to prevent 9/11. And there was an incredible report that was nominated for the National Book Award. In this case, there was also a congressional report. It was put together in the course of a few days following a very brief trip to Russia when they that culminated with a bizarre press conference at the U.S. Embassy that was with the participation of Steven Seagal, the washed-up action star, who is friends with the president of Chechnya. And that report contains less information than was at that point available in the media.
Wow.
So this is not something, if our government agencies are not looking for this information or not producing it, this is not something that I as a journalist can produce.
What's fascinating, I mean, and, you know, because I want to, you know, sort of tie this together, is that the idea behind your exploration of these two in this book is so that we can better understand how this happens. But the idea to me that, and I don't know, you tell me, is the FBI still looking for where these bombs were made? I mean, to me, you haven't done, your investigation's not complete until you find out where these weapons were constructed. That seems to me a huge glaring hole in all of this.
I completely agree. But I think that as with any law enforcement agency, anywhere in the world, if you don't have a civilian agency that is going to make it do its job well and make it accountable to the public, it's not going to do it. And that's what's ultimately not happening in this case.
I wasn't necessarily planning to spend this much time on this aspect of it, but I got to say, Janet Napoliano's op-ed raises a whole lot more questions for me than anything else. I guess it was her review of your book, but I mean, I would think that she'd be a little bit concerned that we never found out where the bombs were made.
You'd think. I mean, but on the other hand, she was Secretary of Homeland Security at the time the bombs went off, so. I think it's no surprise that she takes these accusations somewhat personally. It's a little odd to have her writing a review of the book in that case. She is implied as a character in it.
Yeah, it's fascinating. But it's a fascinating story, and I appreciate your coming on and talking to us about it today. We'll, of course, link to the book at majority.fm. The book is The Brothers, The Road to an American Tragedy. Masha Gessen, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you for great questions.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Wow. So strange, isn't it?
Yeah. I think the what happened in Florida is another bizarre aspect of
the
story.
Oh, yes. I'm sorry. I neglected to get into that.
There's only so much you can cover, but there's a lot of loose threads.
I'd say.
The most bizarre thing that I didn't even know was how they don't know where they made the bombs and they don't seem to care to want to find out. Like, that's bizarre to me.
I mean, that is a very, very, very strange aspect.
Case closed, guys. We got the...
We don't have to really worry about that so much because the chances of that guy making more bombs is probably zero.
Well, for what it's worth, and not only that, they're going after his friends from UMass Dartmouth really hard.
Right.
And they may...
Talking about Johar.
You should explain that.
Yes,
yeah.
Okay. So Johar had some friends at UMass Amherst who I guess were at arm's length enough to have no idea he was up to this, but... They're his roommates or his friends, and they saw that he had, like, fireworks and Vaseline, and they assumed that that's how the bomb was made. And apparently they hid that. They panicked. They didn't know what to do. They wanted to protect their friend and whatnot. And it's quite clear, even as the FBI tells it, that they had nothing to do with it, but they did obstruct the investigation. College kids, and clearly they should not have done that and responded.
Of course.
I mean, there's nothing in any way, but they weren't involved in the making or the plotting or had any pre-knowledge of what was going to happen. They just after the fact said, "Oh, is it possible that our buddy was involved in this? We're gonna hide that from the FBI
until
and probably thinking like when he comes back, we'll confront him." You're like, or what?
Right.
I don't
know. Well, there isn't even any, as you say, though, there in any of the charges. And one of these guys might get 25 years, as far as I understand, the one that didn't plea. There's no one has said, like, oh, they were a part of this or they knew. That hasn't been floated. It's covering up, which is important.
After the fact,
you know, whatever you think of that, regardless of that, it's astonishing that you would go after them in such a draconian way. And then totally ignore.
Well, one indicates like this is very serious stuff, and the other indicates like that.
Hey, that's what I'm saying. And in fact,
we don't know where they got.
I would say it's actually the inverse. Like a little bit more worried about how the bomb was constructed.
Now maybe we'll find out. Maybe we'll find out in 6 months. They have discovered. It's possible. Yeah. They have discovered where it was made. We found. I mean, look. I suspect this is either they're having trouble finding it and they're still looking. It seems unlikely to me that this is like some type of nefarious activity by the FBI, because if they're that nefarious, then you just say, oh, we found it.
I think it's nefarious, but I think there's a competence question.
They found it. They were out in a tent, and they would drive out to Attleboro, Massachusetts, or I don't even know.
You seem to know a lot about this.
I'm thinking of a Massachusetts town and starting with the A's. But it does seem weird. And, you know, that's more of like the defense theoretically could have created an entire theory about this, right? I mean, we've heard many stories, and by stories, I mean it's been reported that the FBI gets very involved in creating the mechanism for would-be terrorists to commit a terrorist act. Now, those mechanisms are generally fake, right? Like, here's the fake way to make a bomb, and here's and you guys should really think about taking over the country, and I will be the one to help you get the boots and the uniforms, that type of thing. So I don't know. There's a lot of questions unanswered, and so there's two elements of this story that I find really compelling. One is that there's a lot of things that are unanswered, I think. The other being that what our approach to terrorism has invested terrorist attacks with more worth to than I think is necessary. In other words, if we treated these as criminal matters, and maybe, you know, I'm against the death penalty, period, but maybe Zohar, he's tried as a criminal, he gets the same penalty. I would have liked it to be life in prison. But nevertheless, the glory is not there. It is not you have been able to mobilize the full powers of the United States military. So I don't know. But it's a fascinating story. All right, we're going to take a break and head into the fun half. Just a reminder, folks, as we head into the fun half to talk about the TPP, to talk about the Koch brothers, to talk about the Patriot Act. I mean, literally the top three stories that I have, Credo Action has mobilized and agitated and lobbied and spent money on all of these three issues, both the Patriot Act, reforming bulk surveillance, fighting the Koch brothers, and in fighting the TPP. Which is why it pleases me so much to have Credo Mobile as a sponsor this month. Go to credomobile.com/majority report. They have a great deal for Majority Report listeners. Check it out. There is literally no reason why you have to not switch to Credo that they don't have an answer for. And, you know, check their they have a, you know, a reception locator. That might be the only one. But they have pretty good coverage. All right. Also, if you want to support this program, please become a member. For whatever reason, we go through little pockets where a lot of people cancel. And we need new people to come in and fill their place. So if you have the financial means to become a member, by all means, please do. You can join today at jointhemajorityreport.com. And justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Get 10% off. They have free shipping now. And also, if you buy crap from Amazon, buy it from our Amazon link at majorityreportkickback.com. Click on the link, bookmark it, buy your crap from there. If you buy crap from Amazon, and we get a little kickback. Don't forget, every time you leave a review for us on iTunes, an angel gets their wings. So if you like angels and you think that it's appropriate for them to fly, because there's nothing more humiliating to an angel when they can't fly, when they walk around and they have one wing and they just fly around in a circle. It's really sad. It's really sad. So go leave us a review on iTunes. And allow that really sad, humiliated angel to fly straight. It's so important. That poor little angel. All right. All right, we'll see you in the fun half. 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920. You can IM me at, use the app at Majority App. We'll be right back.